It's a pleasure to be back at ITP and talk to all of you guys about some of the work that we've been doing in partly on the back burner for almost now 7-8 years, but then suddenly when the 3-5 semiconductors with their high TC ferromagnetism burst into the scene, there's been a lot more activity going on. This talk is going to be very unusual in the sense that I want to first talk about the early part of this work, which is going to be on the blackboard, because that was pre-PowerPoint stuff. And we haven't really done. So I think I'm going to use some hardware techniques to get rid of the screen, discuss with you what we were doing to begin with, and then come back and tell you some of the later stuff more in the PowerPoint mode so that you can get more information on what we're doing currently. Can I borrow somebody's or? Yep, that's what I'm going to do.
Actually, you can blank it.
You can blank it? Ah, that's great. All right, blank and no blank. Okay, if you can turn on the lights, I will. Okay. Yeah, okay. So, our interest, what I'm going to talk to you about is work that's been done at Princeton over the past few years. And there have been lots of different people involved in various aspects of the work, including an undergraduate student who started it all, Adam Durst, who's currently finished his PhD and is a postdoc with Steve Gerwin at Yale. Then graduate students, Xin Wan, who's now at Florida State University, a graduate student, Malcolm Kennett, who's at Cambridge, postdoc Mona Bersiu, who is now a faculty member at UBC, and also Dan Angelescu, who did his graduate project on this topic, but then decided to be an experimentalist. So the question was, in those days, the magnetic semiconductors of Vogue were the 2-6s. And that means things like cadmium telluride, zinc selenide, etc. And where the divalent ion was substituted with manganese. And the point was the manganese being divalent, but at the same time having a unfilled B shell, represented a pure spin of 5 halves in these compounds. So if you just take cadmium manganese telluride or zinc manganese selenide, until you get a concentration of manganese of the order of 20%, there's no real magnetic transition that takes place in these systems. There are no carriers, just magnetic ions. They have nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor exchange interaction is short range because of the very atomic-like nature of the D shell in manganese. And nothing really happens until you get to 20% or thereabouts of manganese. And then it looks like because there's both antiferromagnetism and ferromagnetic interaction between the manganese, you get a spin glass state at low temperatures. So you have a paramagnet at high temperatures, a supposed spin glass at low temperatures. And this was work done in the early 80s. What can happen quite differently is if you then put in a carrier in this system. And typically what one does is one puts a pentavalent impurity like phosphorus on the selenium. So it's really you get a hole because you have an absence of one electron on the selenium site. And if you put a very dilute number of holes, these holes exist in shallow acceptor states in these 2-6 semiconductors. And that's the picture that I'm going to start out with in terms of trying to understand diluted magnetic semiconductors. I think almost all of you know about shallow impurities in semiconductors, but for those who don't, I will primarily talk in electron language for simplicity and forget about the fact that it's really holes and there are complications due to holes, which I'll come to at the end. But if I, for example, have an electron dopant in a semiconductor, typically say phosphorus and silicon or something like that, then the extra electron around the phosphorus is in a shallow Bohr orbit. It's a hydrogenic orbit, and the Bohr radius is something like 20 angstroms. And that's the case even in these systems for electron dopants. For the case of hole dopants, the radius is significantly smaller. It's about 10 to 12 angstroms, so the it's somewhat more tightly bound. But nevertheless, it's much larger than the lattice constant. And that's the main message that I want to start with. What happens when you have carriers in a semiconductor along with spins? Now, if there were no spins in the system, suppose this was phosphorus doped with silicon, then this electron would be a spin 1/2 object. And suppose you put them randomly in a three-dimensional matrix. This work was carried out at Bell Labs by Miko Pallinen and Klaus Andres. The magnetic properties of phosphorus doped silicon are very well known. What happens is that you have pairs of dopants that act like hydrogen molecules. The electrons form a singlet state, as everyone knows. Energy versus distance for a pair of hydrogen atoms has this nice shape. This is the singlet, spin equals zero state. This is the spin one, parallel spin state. And there's your hydrogen molecule, energy versus distance. And so what's happening in phosphorus doped silicon is randomly placed hydrogen atoms. Since the energy gain is maximum when the distance is short, this is of the order of 2 Bohr radii or less. And typical distances in insulating doped semiconductors is 4, 5, 6 Bohr radii. So you're sitting somewhere there on this curve. What happens is, since it's exponential with distance, pairs that have large interactions gain that energy by forming singlets. They're magnetically inert, and the process keeps on continuing. And as far as we know, starting at 300 degrees, which is the maximum exchange that you can get, down to about 10 millidegrees, there is no magnetic ordering in this system. All that happens is that you get this pair formation. So one might think that there might be something similar going on there, and that's really what started us going, and by us I mean Peter Wolf, who was then at NEC. Peter came from a different background. He was interested in magnetic polarons. And so let's change the subject a little bit. Instead of phosphorus and silicon, let's think about an electron dopant in cadmium manganese telluride or zinc manganese selenide. So now you have your electron, but you have a bunch of manganese in the system. And what we are interested in is a specific region of concentration where concentration of manganese is much less than the percolation concentration. This is, as I said, about 20%. The concentration of the carriers is going to be much less than X. So there are very few carriers per manganese or per spin, but we're going to be interested in a regime where the effective concentration of the carrier is large compared to manganese. And you can do that because the Bohr radius is significantly larger than the wave function of the d electron in manganese. So even if this is a tenth or even less than that, a hundredth of the manganese concentration, if this is 10 times the manganese Bohr manganese radius, you can satisfy this and that at the same time. And that's a particular region in materials parameters that you can get with semiconductors, which you cannot get in most either inorganic, insulating or metallic materials. And that's, all of it has to do with the fact that this is a large length scale in the problem.
There's a limit in which you can forget about the impurity band and think that your electron goes directly to either the conduction or the valence band.
Right.
Now, is it clear when one is in that limit?
Yes. It's not clear. That transition is actually it's gradual in some sense. It depends on where the Fermi energy in your system is. I'm right now concentrating on the very low density end, where you're basically in the impurity limit. If you have a good, presumably once you go to the carriers in the valence or the conduction band, you have a good metal, or maybe slightly dirty metal. The problem in the diluted magnetic semiconductors is if you actually look at the conductivity of these materials, gallium manganese, arsenide, or 2-6s, it's really very bad. If you look at low temperatures, there's always resistivity rising at low temperatures.
But that crossover is not really well understood theoretically, right?
No, no, it's not well understood. I mean, it's barely understood without the spins. Now you have manganese spins complicating the whole business in addition. So, what is known is that if you take phosphorus doped silicon or doped germanium, that the metal insulator transition seems to take place in an impurity band, and then slowly you go into the conduction band. So if you are on the insulating side, you're certainly in the impurity band limit. If you are a very dirty metal, you could be one way or the other. Okay, so coming back to this problem, suppose we had a few carriers and a bunch of manganese. Then there's an exchange interaction between the manganese and the carrier, which is of the which can be written as the carrier spin S dotted with the manganese spin SK, and with some coefficient, which basically is the wave function of the carrier at the manganese spins. So it's very much like a hyperfine interaction. The manganese d electron is a tight wave function. It's pretty much point-like, whereas the carrier wave function is extended, and so it really depends on how often the carrier spins on the manganese site, and that's what determines the exchange interaction between those. Now, what I say doesn't matter whether this exchange is antiferromagnetic or ferromagnetic. What are the ultimate properties? They are pretty similar, and the reason for that is, even though if this is antiferromagnetic, the carrier will try to align itself oppositely to the manganese. The carrier spin is 1/2. The manganese spin is 5/2. There are lots of manganese per carrier, so this carrier spin really, its moment is negligible. All the magnetic action is all due to the manganese in this system. So the picture here is very simple. Suppose I had just one carrier, then at low temperatures, what's going to happen is, because of this exchange interaction, let me take it to be antiferromagnetic for illustrative purposes, the carrier is going to go antiferromagnetically aligned to the manganese. It'll try and align as many manganese as it can, and the alignment is a competition between the energetic gain that you have and the entropy that you lose in the manganese spin. So you can actually estimate how far this alignment is going to go simply by saying, well, I'm going to just match the wave function at some distance r from the center of the carrier, the donor location squared, and versus kBT. And there's some spin factors there because, you know, it's kT log 2s plus 1. So this says that e to the minus 2r over ab is of the order of kBT, and that immediately tells you that the radius is going to be of order, the Bohr radius over 2 log, there's some coefficient, of course, in front, energy coefficient, log j naught over kBT. So what this is saying is that if I have a single carrier, I'm going to have a magnetic polaron that's going to align all the manganese either parallel or antiparallel to the carrier, and this polaron is going to grow in size logarithmically with temperature, simply because it's an entropy and energy consideration. So this polaron is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger as you go to lower temperatures.
The quantum change is ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic?
This one is antiferromagnetic. So what this is saying is that a given polaron, of course, is going to be pretty much a ferromagnetic object. It may have one spin antiferromagnetically aligned, but all the manganese, there are so many more manganese that this quantity is really a huge ferromagnetic object. So in some sense, those people who are thinking in terms of Kondo lattices or heavy fermions, we have to recognize we are in a completely different region of phase space here. We have many more spins than there are carriers. The spin quantum number of manganese is much bigger than the spin quantum number of the carrier. So there's no question of compensation at all. There is, the manganese are going to win out no matter what you do. The only possibility of not winning out is if something like phosphorus doped silicon happened. That is, because of carrier-carrier hopping, if this carrier wants to align opposite, and the manganese here start aligning parallel to antiparallel to it, then there would be cancellation. And that was actually what we first thought might happen in this system, that you'd get this formation of these very large ferromagnetic polarons, and then at lower temperatures when carrier hopping started taking place, because this is JE to the minus, this is carrier hopping, T is E to the minus, let me call capital R over AB, where R is the distance between these carriers. And that's much bigger than the Bohr radius because we are at low concentration.
So can we forget about the RKKY interaction and the direct
exchange? Yeah, at this stage, yes.
How about the direct exchange between the manganese?
We can forget about that because I'm putting X much less than X. So I'm talking about 1% manganese, for example, or very low percentage of manganese. So because the exchange, the point is that the Bohr radius here is much, much bigger than the extent of the manganese wave function. You can always get into a regime where the manganese-manganese exchange is going to be falling off much sharper. So you may have some manganese-manganese interaction for clusters that occasionally occur. In that case, you have to deal with that cluster and treat it as a special spin. But in the end, at long distances, it's this that's going to take over.
So if I use the language of the Kondo lattice, you are basically in this sort of exhaustion regime, where
right.
Very, very few.
Yeah. Yeah, you are very few, very, very few.
You get from magnetic.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly.
Why,
so this is.
Why is it you can collect RKKY or
so much? Simply because we are in a regime which is very, very dilute. Each of the wave function, the wave functions are localized around each donor. We don't have really carriers in the band. So I'm talking about very low concentration. This is 1%, this may be 10 to the 17 or less, for example. So in that regime, this could happen. Of course, to cut a long story short, it turned out it doesn't happen. The reason it doesn't happen is because there are lots of manganese in the middle who get very frustrated. When one polaron starts having all the manganese up, the other one's having them down, they lose a lot of exchange energy. And that exchange energy loss is actually bigger than the gain that you get from the carrier hopping. So I don't want to go into this story, but I'm happy to discuss that with anybody at some time. What happens is the manganese carrier exchange wins, and what you're left with is manganese that are all pointing in one direction, carriers with spins in the other direction if this is antiferromagnetic, and you have a pretty much a ferromagnetic system forming. And the polarons are getting bigger and bigger and bigger as the temperature goes lower. So in this 2-6 semiconductors, in this regime of very low carrier concentration and low manganese concentration, the way ferromagnetism can be pictured to grow is polarons that are getting bigger in size. And they are randomly placed. It depends on where your where the donors are. That's the center of the polarons. So you would expect that as you started out with high temperatures, you had a bunch of polarons around each of the donors. You went to slightly lower temperatures, these polarons started getting bigger and started touching each other. And at some point, pretty much you have a hard sphere percolation problem. When the polarons start touching, all the spins start aligning of each of the polarons. And then at some temperature where the radius of the polarons is appropriate, you're going to have a percolated system of magnetically aligned manganese spins. And this we identify as the transition to a truly ferromagnetic state in the system at low temperatures. The thing that is peculiar about this ferromagnet, though, compared to standard lattice or uniform ferromagnets, is that you can see that in a three-dimensional percolation, if you have sphere percolating, you find that about 16% or 20% volume fraction that already percolates, which means you can get global ferromagnetism in this system much before the voids in the system where there are lots of manganese that have hardly felt any carrier are going to order. So there's the possibility in this system, as you go down in temperature, that you start with polarons forming, then polarons percolate. But even after they percolate in the ferromagnetic phase, you've got lots of free moments hanging around. Yes?
I always thought that as you form the polaron around the donor, that you actually dug a deeper and deeper potential for the donor, so the wave function actually began to shrink.
Yes, that can happen. And there is, but ultimately, once it's all polarized, that it saturates. And then it can, then the process. So you're right, there can be a hiccup in this process. And if you actually look at careful experiments that the Polish group has done, there is a little hiccup. But in the end, there will be something like that. That'll just change this chain on that you have because, or that'll change the Bohr radius. It'll change it to some different Bohr radius at low temperatures.
How does magnet resistance behave at that percolation point?
Magnet resistance. We haven't actually done that calculation, but I would assume that there would be significant magnet resistance right at that percolation point. Yes.
What's the actual physical measurement that differentiates between when you're below percolation and above percolation?
We should look for bulk magnetization spontaneous.
You say it's only 16%. I mean, the bulk magnetization doesn't.
No, it's not. Once you're below the percolation threshold, there's a finite fraction of the system is percolated, so there will be a finite bulk magnetization. It'll be small. It won't be very big. So yes, it is saying that at least in this regime, you're going to have to be very careful in terms of how you're going to extrapolate to zero field. And
even if you're below percolation, there is this incipient cluster,
right?
And it still will be one uniform magnetization. So it will be gradually magnetization growth.
Yeah, in a finite field, that you really have a problem. I agree. You have the what I'm trying to say is that if you, one thing that can be very easily seen, and that has been experimentally seen, I'm afraid I don't have the view graph, but Jeffrey Liu at NEC, what he did was he looked at high temperatures, well above the percolation phenomenon, or rather very low densities where the percolation threshold is very low in temperature. And what he found was that you can, if you look at the magnetization of this, or susceptibility, you find dm dh that you calculate, measure versus log of field, you get a curve that looks like this at low temperatures. And this was happening at about 300 Gauss, and this was happening at 30,000 Gauss. And the point is, you're getting one susceptibility, DMDH, due to these guys, because this is acting like a 50 Bohr magneton object. And this is the free spins that are hanging around. So this picture that you have, some that are acting as part of the, of course it's a simplified picture. Every single, this is not a well-defined, this is just an order of magnitude of the radius. It's not a well-defined, you're in the polaron or you're not. But the fact that it's exponential with distance does help. It makes it very quite sharp, the boundary. And so what you find is you get this is, from the polaron, this is the susceptibility of the polarons, and this is the susceptibility of the free spins. And that saturates at 30,000 Gauss, as you expect for free spins. This saturates at 300 Gauss. So you can do those kinds of measurements and actually get out information. This was done at 2 Kelvin, I believe, and concentration of 10 to the 17 acceptors.
So what is the TC of these things typically?
These things are very low TC.
Okay.
for the same reason.
What is very low, though?
Very low means below 100. The best in 2.6s that I know of is a 1 or 2 Kelvin. What I'm trying to point out is that even though the TC is very low, so it depends very much what your point of view is. If you want to get high TC, these are not materials to look at. But on the other hand, there's some very fascinating physics at low temperatures that can be that can be done with these systems, which...
Has anyone done Raman scattering on this to look at the all around?
Yeah. People have done optical measurements on these materials, yeah. But all of this is way in the paramagnetic phase. Nobody's really gone down into very low temperature. You need millikelvin temperatures to get any ferromagnetism or any information of the ferromagnetic state. What I'm about to tell you is the ferromagnetic state is quite unusual in this system, and it's something that can be looked at from a scientific point of view. From a technological point of view, I don't know whether there's any interest at all. So the idea is that these polarons are going to start increasing in radius and then eventually percolate and form a real ferromagnet. But the real ferromagnet is a very, very randomized, ramified object. And therefore, what you're going to get is a magnetization that's very much different from the standard. You know, you can take Ising models or you can take Heisenberg models, XY models, anything that orders in high enough dimensions, and you look at magnetization versus temperature for a ferromagnet, that's the curve that you get. And the two points that I'd like to mention is you can do critical point theory, long wavelength theory starting from here, and you get the exponent and you sort of let it ride. You start from here and you do spin wave or domain wall analysis and you let that ride, and you know, low temperature and high and TC expansions give you phenomena within sort of 10-15% of the actual curve. And they've been very useful in trying to understand magnetic phenomena.
Is the low temperature ferromagnetic phase semiconductor? What is the transport?
It should be semiconductor. It should be semiconductor. Resistivity, yeah. This is all very low carrier concentration, so. Now, what happens in this case, of course, is quite different. What is happening is that there are lots of free spins that are hanging around that are not part of the ferromagnetic cluster. So instead of rising like this, one expects something that looks more like that compared to saturation magnetization. And then only when this radius starts engulfing these other free manganese spins will they become part of the full ferromagnetic domain. And that's going to happen at exponentially lower temperatures. You see, the radius is only increasing logarithmically with temperature. So you need to go to an exponentially low temperature before the radius doubles. So what happens is when you try and do the magnetization for a system like this, you get curves that look like that. And this actually was, what we did was, we being Shin Wan, my student and myself, is we, there's no Rian, just, is take a model of randomly placed donors coupled to randomly placed manganese on the zinc blend lattice, put in the simple hydrogenic wave function, psi of r goes like e to the minus r over Bohr radius, with a Bohr radius that was suitably chosen, and numerical simulations on a classical Heisenberg, taking them to be classical Heisenberg spins rather than quantum spins, you get reproduced this kind of curve very accurately. The other thing that of course happens is that all these spins that are not, so the two things that are there is you try and do critical point theories and you find you can just explain a little bit of here, because then most of this rise in magnetization is coming from the polarons increasing in size. It's not coming from just the whole thing ordering uniformly. And the same thing here, you may do spin wave expansions, but the spin waves contribute nothing as far as the entropy, low temperature entropy of the system is concerned. All the low temperature entropy is coming from the very rare spins that haven't formed part of the polarons. So in fact, this downturn is quite dramatic. It can be made as high as you want depending on the concentration that you started out with. And it seems to be for reasonable concentrations. We took a concentration which was about half the metal insulator transition density in cadmium or in zinc selenide, and we found roughly linear dependence. Now that's not, it's not linear really speaking, but it's roughly linear. So it's a very different kind of beast that you get. You can then ask yourself, what does the susceptibility look like as a function of temperature? And sure enough, at TC, you find you have a singularity of the susceptibility for, as for any Heisenberg magnet that orders. But then at low temperatures, you get a temp size independent susceptibility peak. And if you look at reasonable size samples that you can numerically do, this is huge compared to that. Most of the entropy is sitting here. There's very little entropy in the transition itself. Specific heat, you have to do a little bit better because one knows that if you do classical spins specific heat, you get finite specific heat at low temperatures for Heisenberg spins. So that's a wrong result. It's a result of not having quantum mechanics in there. So what we did was we took the manganese spins to have six directions. Since it was spin 5/2, we just said, well, arbitrarily, we just mimic it with a classical spin that can point in the 100 directions. But it's not allowed to point anywhere else. And when you do that, you find that you get a specific heat peak again. And I should write something here that this is as a function of log D. This could be as much as one or two orders of magnitude below. So you could have action going on 10 at TC over 10, which you never get in most magnets. And same thing with specific heat peak. This TC is somewhere there, and there's hardly, for the small sizes we study, we can barely discern any anomaly at the transition. And you see most of the anomaly well below the transition where these spins that haven't ordered start ordering. So it's the most probable temperature for ordering of the spins where all the action is taking place. So one of the messages of this is, and for realistic models, I think people doing that, it's an interesting result that there's very little universality in this. The people who do only universal physics will not be able to get most of this unless they put the percolation picture as part of their universal picture. And you can, depending on the concentration, you get curves that look like this, or and then eventually start becoming that. So you get a full family of magnetization curves that depend on what. So if I write M over M naught versus T over TC, you can cover the whole blackboard depending on the concentration that you have.
What about experiments?
Well, unfortunately, in these 2-6 materials, the experiments are lacking primarily because the TC itself is very low. The one or two.
What is the order?
TC of 1 or 2 degrees has been seen in metallic doped systems. In the insulating doped systems, it'll be probably 100 millikelvin or less. And so that's where the real problem comes. You have to try, and the coupling constants are low because the wave functions are so extended. And so I think there's a lot of interesting physics that is there in this ferromagnet. Disorder effects are extremely important and dominant, but as far as the experimental picture is concerned, you need to go to very low temperatures to do it. Maybe some of the old low T experimentalists can find something interesting to do here.
What is the order of magnitude of J0? What is what determines this? That's like the Kondo coupling.
That's right? The Kondo coupling. Yeah. Ah. So this temperature is going to be of order tens of Kelvin or more.
But how much does it vary? What determines that J0? If you have some simple physical picture?
Yeah, what determines the J0 is, to some extent, is the size of the wave function. That's the most important thing. The more you shrink the wave function,
but J0 is a bare parameter, right? You were trying to get two energy scales.
Right. J0 is the exchange in interaction between. Yeah, so J0 also is determined by where the manganese level is relative to the band. So yes, you can. Those are also things that you can tune. The problem that you run into is that no matter what you do, it's because of this logarithmic effect, it's only log dependent logarithmically on J0. So you can't change things too much. You may change it, unless you change it by orders of magnitude, then you might get better. So you
can J0 be in reality? I mean, in manganite, that thing is huge.
Yeah. No, in so in 3-5 it is huge.
20,000 degrees divided by 100 degrees.
Right.
Even if it's in the log.
No, in the 2-6s there are big problems. The thing is that the the two issues. If you're going to do with the valence band, most of the wave function is sitting on the tellurium side, or so, whereas the manganese is substituting on the cadmium side. So that's one of the problems that you're stuck with. That the manganese is not on the site where most of the carrier wave function is. When I say that this is the impurity wave function, it's derived from obviously the host valence band.
Sure.
You can try going to the conduction band and get more of that, but then the way the impurity becomes shallower, and then the Bohr radius increases, and so all this physics is shunted to lower concentrations and again lower temperatures. So it's a difficult situation to get out of. It's unfortunate, but that's the way nature has made it for us.
Can you comment on how much this is applicable to gallium?
I'm coming next to that. All right, let me next go to, so let's go back. I press this again, and hopefully now I have. So we were looking at this fascinating physics and not worrying about what was the use of any of that. Okay, so as you can see, this is really, I borrowed this PowerPoint presentation from my postdoc, Mona Bersiu, who gave this presentation at Aspen this summer. And so it has all the fancy PowerPoint aspects to it, but let me try and get to the punchlines a little bit more. Okay. So the idea is we go now from 2-6 semiconductors to 3-5s, and and all of a sudden when that was done by Ono and co-workers, what they found was that you can get transition temperatures that were in the hundreds of Kelvin or several tens of Kelvin and no longer, you know, down to millikelvin temperatures. And the idea there was when you put manganese and gallium manganese arsenide, the manganese is going on the gallium site. And so since this is divalent and that's trivalent, not only is it giving the spin 5 house, but it's also contributing a carrier. It's giving a hole. And if that was the case, there are several advantages to that. If one actually were looking at the impurity picture for gallium manganese arsenide, so I look at very, very low concentrations X, then the impurity wave function is actually peaked at the very site where the spin is. So you're actually increasing the spin carrier coupling quite a bit, simply because the carrier is sitting on that site most of the time. So just to amplify that point again, in cadmium manganese telluride, what you're going to have is a carrier wave function like this, and the manganese are sort of somewhere, you know, I'm sort of drawing it on in a one-dimensional, but they're not sitting at the site. This is where the carrier is. That's where you put in a phosphorus or something like that. So the manganese are never going to be seeing the peak of the wave function, whereas, so this is 2-6s, whereas if you do 3-5s, what we're saying is this is the manganese side, and that's where the spin is, and the carrier wave function is peaked right there. And in that sense, one might naively, of course, one can say that at high concentration, all the carriers are in the valence or the conduction band, but you're losing out by doing that, because the wave function of the in the conduction or valence band, the envelope factor is constant, and it's significantly lower than what happens when you have a bunched up wave function sitting at the impurity site. So you're losing coupling constant by doing that. So it is, if you're actually going to try to engineer a substance with the highest TC that you can, you actually want a wave function like this, not a wave function like that.
But I'm still not clear about the Kondo coupling, because there are really two limits which physically we understand very well. One, if we have the Anderson model, then we know that we can do a Schiffer-Wolf transformation, and then we get an anti-ferromagnetic Kondo coupling.
Right.
But we also know the cases where we have manganites, that we have a local Hund-Sund coupling
right.
that tries to align the spins, and then we get a ferromagnetic Kondo coupling.
Right.
So we have these two extremes. Now you bring these systems, how do we know really what the sign and how big the Kondo coupling
is? Ask Nicola, she's the local expert in these things. The point is, as far as the ferromagnetism in this system is concerned, it doesn't matter which sign the Kondo
coupling. No, I know, but just for, I mean, I'm not very familiar with this material. I just wanted to place it in.
Well, the holes are supposed to be antiferromagnetically coupled to the manganese spin.
Right.
That is the calculation that one finds when one does energetics in this system. And so if you're really, really interested in gallium manganese arsenide, it's an antiferromagnetic coupling. Mm.
But at least one would like to learn how to tune this, right?
Yes. So I think that, yeah, one would like to know how to tune it. But I think the point I'm trying to make is the tuning that you're normally used to, which is just energy denominators, that you can certainly do. But there's one additional part that you can do, which is what is the wave function of the carrier. You have carrier wave function engineering that can be done in this system, which you cannot do in other systems, high carrier density systems. And I think that may actually be more useful. Okay. So anyway, this is just telling you what happens when you put manganese in gallium manganese arsenide. And the point is then 3-5 semiconductors, you can get a transition temperature to a ferromagnetic state that's been seen at 110 Kelvin with 5% manganese. So one of the questions we wanted to ask was, can some of the physics of what we did in the 2-6 semiconductors apply to the 3-5s? And let me give you reasons why I think some of that might be relevant. First of all, where the transition temperature is high is low manganese carrier manganese density. It's between 1 and 5%. After that, it starts coming down again. Or if you try to anneal the samples, they seem to saturate. But basically, beyond 5%, nothing seems to work. So if you're interested in the low manganese concentration, you've got to be a little bit careful about just dumping all the holes in the valence band. Second thing that is also being seen experimentally is that this system is extremely compensated. At least in the early stages, it looked like there was only 10% of the carriers that compared to manganese. One would expect one hole per manganese, but as soon as you put in, go into the system and then try to measure the carrier concentration, it turns out to be, some people say 10%, other people have said 30%, and more recently it's becoming more like 50-70%. And you know, as you get to higher concentration of carriers, of course, many of the anomalous effects that we are talking about will not apply. So we started building a model that was based on this low density limit. So again, we are looking at low carrier densities, low manganese concentrations, and we are taking advantage of the fact that the number of manganese sites is much larger than the number of carriers. Why is there this discrepancy? It's supposed to be there are at least two candidates. One is that there's anti-site defects where gallium is put on arsenic sublattice, and that acts as a donor and gobbles up two holes. Another possibility is manganese interstitials, which are supposed to gobble up another two holes because they have two electrons in their outer shell. So some combination of this and maybe some other unknown compensation mechanism is getting the system rid of holes. So we have to deal with the system with very few holes and low manganese concentration. And so we're going to start with the low density limit, basically take isolated impurity wave functions on the manganese sites and try and form a theory based on that. If you start with holes in the valence band and calculate screening lengths, then you find that the screening length is of the order of 10 angstroms at these concentrations. So it's a pretty large screening length if you look at it that way. And so you seem to be in this system somewhere in the middle of the very isolated impurity picture versus the band picture. So here are some of the experimental data. That is TC versus concentration. As I said, it goes up to 110 degrees. This is the concentration of the holes. on the right side. And if you look at the resistivity of these in ohm centimeters, you find they're extremely dirty metals. Even the best metallic samples, which are these ones here, are pretty bad metals. And the other ones seem to be pretty good, you know, headed to insulating behavior at low temperatures. Okay. So the Hamiltonian we decided to work with is, in this case, since the carriers were in bound states, hydrogenic bound states, we could get away with a pure spin Hamiltonian. Here we can't do that because there are more sites than there are carriers. So what we did was, this is an impurity tight binding description of the impurity band. I and J refer to sites of the impurity, the manganese impurities. And then we have an exchange interaction between the spin of the manganese and the carrier wave function at that manganese site, which is controlled by some, of course, coupling constant that you're talking about, but also the amplitude of finding the carrier at that site, or the probability of finding the carrier at that site. So since this has an envelope that is decaying with a Bohr radius, it's not sitting only on the manganese site, it's on many manganese sites. The typical manganese-manganese distance is less than a Bohr radius. It's not less than a Bohr radius, but it's of the order of a Bohr radius, so you can't just sort of stop it at the first.
But the donor is centered on the manganese, right?
The donor is centered on the manganese. And here we have taken, again, the simplification that we deal with only donors, so spin orbit coupling has been left out, valence band degeneracy has been left out, and all the rest of it. And I'll come to that at the end of the talk. We have left out, we have kept the Coulomb interaction between the hole and the impurity, of course. That's the main reason why we have impurity wave functions. And the reason we can do this numerically is because we have one orbital per manganese, unlike if we were trying to do a full band calculation, we'd have one orbital per gallium and one per arsenic. So you'd have many, many more, a much bigger matrix to diagonalize than we have with the impurity band picture. Okay. And we take a hopping that sort of a hydrogenic type with an effective Bohr radius. The Bohr radius we get is about 8 angstroms. It comes from isolated impurity calculation of Padraigarji and Guillaume. Okay. Technical detail, this was solved two ways. This Hamiltonian was first solved using mean field theory. And the mean field theory that we talk about is a position-dependent mean field theory. So you actually solve self-consistently for the wave functions on each of the impurity sites. That determined, then we find out what the expectation value of the spin is, you know. So we're taking the exchange Hamiltonian, replacing, doing the standard factorization, where this is the expectation values in blue. And the idea is that self-consistently we're going to solve at each site. And since the sites are not identical, we're going to have different expectation values of the spin at each site. And once we do that, then we have to re-diagonalize and keep on doing self-consistently till we get a state that is that we converge to.
But your TIJs depends on the phis, right?
The TIJs depend on the distance between the two.
Okay.
It's just dependent on the distance of the two manganese. So it's a quenched random variable. But it's a realistic quenched random variable in the sense that we take hydrogenic orbitals and do that.
I'm still confused about something. Where do the electrons come that compensate some of these manganese?
The claim is that it comes from manganese that are interstitial. Some of them come because manganese interstitially would.
They're additional impurities.
There are additional impurities. Manganese that come, or it could be gallium and arsenic anti-site defects, where you've got a bunch of atoms on the wrong sublattice and therefore contributing electrons and gobbling up holes. That's the expected.
But then you also have some additional impurity sites that will give scattering and other things that are just not magnetic, so you're not including them.
Right. In this case, we have not dealt. We have sort of just basically taken away the carriers and done. That's what we're presenting. we can do anything. I mean, it is not more difficult to have a model to do and put in other kinds of specific impurities. We did not do that because that's not known yet. It certainly was not known when we did the calculation. But we can do that. That's not a problem. It's the main assumption here is that we don't need the full lattice. We just need the manganese sites. And we're going to just do it in terms of those orbitals. Okay. So first thing we did was just basically do the mean field theory, assuming that the manganese were on an ordered superlattice. And of course, depending on the concentration, we find magnetization curve. This is the magnetization of the manganese. That's the magnetization of the hole. And it's, as one expects, it's a curve that sort of looks pretty much like that. There's a little kink in here because of the fact that the manganese spin is 5/2 and the carrier spin is 1/2 in this system. And therefore, and the number of carriers is low. It's taken to be 10%. Of the manganese concentration. And sort of, if you try and do this lattice calculation, you can try, you have an adjustable parameter, which is basically the coupling constant, which you have taken from Bharachargyi and Guillaume's work. And it seems to fit the experimental data roughly. But the point is that we believe that this agreement in some sense is fortuitous because none of the, because at least for low concentration of carriers, the curves would not seem to be something like this. Okay. The next thing we did was starting, instead of the ordered manganese superlattice, we started disordering the superlattice. We changed it so that you could move one of the superlattice positions to one of the nearest neighbors. And the curve started looking funny as soon as we did that. Just a little bit of disorder.
You're working in some finite-sized system.
Finite-sized system, yes. About 500 spins.
And then you have periodic boundary.
Periodic boundary.
Even when you have disorder.
Yeah, even when we have disorder, right. So it's a huge supercell, basically, if you will.
You have ensemble averages of randomness?
Yes, ensemble average. About 5 or 6 samples seem to be reasonable. Or ensemble average, at least the mean field results.
And how big was the Bohr radius again?
Bohr radius in this case is 8 to 9 angstroms. The next thing we did was we allowed them to be more random. The only constraint was that none of them could be more closer than 2 lattice spacings. And you find the curve in blue. And then finally we said just randomly place them so long as they don't sit on top of each other. And the next thing we found, the TC magnetization curves were completely different. And you start seeing at this stage that this is qualitatively quite similar. This is all a finite size effect, obviously. The near TC, we can't do anything with a finite system. We have to do finite size scaling to locate TC and things like that. But nevertheless, the point we're trying to make is that these curves are beginning to look like the 2-6s at these very low concentrations of manganese. This is, remember, this is 1%, just below 1% manganese, and 10% compensation level, which is 10% holes compared to manganese. So it's 0.1% holes. One of the surprises was that TC became very large. And there are two reasons for that. One is, of course, mean field theory always overestimates TC, and it will overestimate it quite a bit more for random systems than it does for ordered systems. The reason is, what happens is locally something starts becoming ferromagnetic. The mean field theory immediately says that's a ferromagnet, because what's happening is the local TCs are becoming very large because there are some places where there are clusters of manganese, and that mimicking a higher concentration. And that's not a true effect. That's just the artifact of the calculation. There's a second thing which I think is really true, which is that if you have randomness in positions, then the system can figure out how to find a percolative path and form a ferromagnet. And that, I think, is a real effect in this system.
What is the basic physics driving your ferromagnetism? Is it the lowering the kinetic energy of the ball because the spin background is parallel, like sort of Nagaoka kind of physics? I mean, I'm just trying to understand the gist of your mechanism.
It's mostly exchange. Most of the energy is just exchange energy.
Which exchange?
Between hole. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And the carrier wave functions are just, you know, we calculate them self-consistently, but they're not, it's not in the limit of very large energy where you really want it, but it's the kinetic energy that matters. It's a very intermediate case where everything matters, it looks like.
You also have kinetic energy because you have
some extension. Right. Sure. Right. You also get a kinetic energy. That's there in the calculation, but it's not the whole story. Most of the we think about 80% of the energy is coming from the exchange, and the other 20% is coming from the lowering of the kinetic energy.
Can you say whether this is metallic or not from your mean field calculation?
Yeah.
This is just your metallic behavior, right? No.
Not at this concentration. We find metallic behavior at over 1.5%. Mean field says that we did 3% and we did 1%. 1% looks insulating, 3% looks metallic in this mean field calculation.
So you have also calculated resistivity or
we haven't calculated resistivity, but we've calculated wave functions. So we look whether the wave functions are extended or whether they are localized.
Or density of states.
Yeah. Or then we also calculate density of states. We can do, the reason we have not done many of the things is because this is just a model impurity band calculation. I think what really is needed if you want to try and explain real gallium manganese arsenide is to actually do real impurity wave functions, find out the tails of the impurity wave function, and redo this kind of a calculation. That's a future project that I'm hoping to try and entice people, at least one person in this audience, get involved in it. we'll see. So, and this is telling you why such a simultaneously we calculate the whole probabilities at different sites, and we find that while the small disorder is a very peak distribution, for this complete random disorder we actually find it's a two peak distribution. That is, the holes like to find the best manganese sites that they want to visit, and they primarily sit on that, and then there's a very little probability of getting holes on other sites. So it's as if the system is figuring out which sites it wants to visit and polarize, and it forms a filamentary ferromagnet at these concentrations. So that's why TC could be quite large compared to, because these guys are ones that are neighbors that are much lower distance than typical. Along with them, at the same time, while the TC is going up, at low temperatures you find the magnetization is much lower, and that's again because there are isolated manganese sites which don't seem to have much hole concentration on them. The holes barely go to those sites. And because of that, the specific heat peak not only has something at the transition, but there's a big peak well below the transition. This is almost an order and a half below the transition. So at these very, very low concentrations, that you again get very similar phenomena to what we saw in the 2.6s. Okay. When you go to higher manganese concentration, these curves start becoming much more normal. This is, I wouldn't say, is significantly different than any standard mean field curve. And whole concentration has been raised to 30%. So once you get your compensation to become less and less, then you're going to get back to the situation that you have for a standard ferromagnet, simply because all the manganese sites have to be visited and you get a much more mean field description. We've also done Monte Carlo simulations on the same model. So this is free fermions coupled to spins, but the spins are classical spins, vector spins, instead of quantum spins. And you find the same kind of behavior. This is the polarization of the manganese versus temperature. You find that it's coming down very, very rapidly for all these concentrations, 1% and 3%, whole compensation, 10% or 30%. And it's pretty linear. This is a finite size effect. For Monte Carlo simulations, we can only do 100 spins or thereabouts, and so we can't really do much bigger than that. There are mechanisms to make it go to zero, which we avoided in this simple simulation, but we can do that. That's not a problem. The other thing that, the first thing that you, that is important to realize is TCs here are significantly less than the TCs in the mean field simulations, especially for the very low hole concentration and manganese concentration. There's a factor of 7 between the two TCs. So that's where the mean field gets it wrong. You get polarization at one point, and it says it's a ferromagnet, whereas in reality, of course, this part is polarized, but it can rotate, and it only when it couples to the other parts does the real TC. On the other hand, if you go to 30% holes at 3% manganese concentration, the difference is like 15%, 18%. So the mean field, in terms of quantitatively, is much better at the higher hole concentrations and the higher manganese concentrations. But the fact that it's a very anomalous curve at low concentrations is seen in the mean field results. This Monte Carlo results have been done by Malcolm Kennett. And if anybody is interested, we have this has been accepted and is appearing for Israel B very soon. In terms of experiments, I'd like to show data from here, from David Ashalom's group. These are magnetizations that are inferred from the dichroism data at different concentrations of manganese in gallium manganese arsenide, 0.01 plus silicon means that you compensated even more. This is 0.01%, 3.5%, 5%. And in all these cases, what you should notice is that the magnetization curves are nowhere near the standard bulged out. And in addition, they are very, very strongly magnetic field dependent, which suggests that there are several polarizable magnetic entities that are there. Other thing is that they are nowhere near saturation at well below the transition temperature. You know, factor of 5, factor of 7 below the transition temperature, the curves are still going up. It's nowhere.
Is this the dichroism in the optical?
Yeah, in the optical data. And the same thing, they can get the whole magnetization by looking at a different part of the optical dichroism data. And again, the same story seems to repeat itself, that it's very, very steep. It's roughly linear. It's very magnetic field dependent. And if I go back to the Monte Carlo data, you'll see that the same thing happens, that these curves are pretty much proportional to those curves. So the hole and the manganese magnetization do go hand in hand, and both of them are anomalous. Let me show you a data of the magnetization. Well, this is not exactly what I normally do, but there's been data taken by the ONO group, magnetization versus temperature. One is doing anomalous magnetoresistance, the other one is doing squid measurements. And in one case you see a data curve that looks like that, the other case you see a curve that looks like that. So this is magnetoresistance, this is squid. And the reason why we feel that's happening is how you get magnetization from anomalous magnetoresistance is through a formula like this. From Hall resistivity. And this assumes that you have basically a uniform system. So you can treat it as if there is a uniform magnetization, and there's a normal Hall effect due to the magnetic field that you put, anomalous Hall effect due to the average magnetization that exists in the sample, and based on that they get a magnetization curve like this. Now, we believe that Hall effect and magnetoresistance, most transport properties will be more sensitive to where the carriers are near the Fermi level. And these carriers happen to reside along the percolating backbone in our model, at least. Which means that they're really going to see things that are fully magnetized. The ones that are not fully magnetized are far away from the percolating backbone, and that will only be captured in a bulk magnetization measurement. So one of the predictions would be that there would be a difference between bulk magnetization and magnetization inferred from transport data.
is that red line supposed to convince me that there's a difference?
I don't know. This is not my... let me see if the other one is there. No, it's not there, unfortunately. These are not the curve that I would have shown. This is the curve that you see if you do a bulk magneto transport. But if you look at the other, I will show you the other curve. I'm happy to give you the reference to that other curve.
If you have some little prejudice even in the low curve, you see something.
A little bit, yeah, maybe. Yeah, if you have prejudice, yes. Okay. We've also looked at other detailed properties like whether the system is metallic or non-metallic in the mean field theory. We can calculate electronic wave functions, and what we find is that the 1% sample, actually the Fermi level lies in the insulating regime. The inverse participation ratio, which is just the ratio of the fourth moment of the wave function at different sites divided by the second moment squared, is independent of size for that case. And whereas when you do it for the 3% or 5% sample, we find that it depends on size, suggesting we have a delocalization transition in this system. Okay. We've also calculated magnetic properties of spin waves or magnetic excitations. And interestingly, what you find is that as you increase the disorder, of course, the spectrum becomes broader and broader on a logarithmic scale. This is done using a random phase approximation. And what you find, again, if you look at the spin wave or the magnetic excitation inverse participation ratio, what you find is that towards the edge of the spectrum, its localized excitations don't seem to depend very much on the size of the system. It's in the middle that you have extended magnetic excitation. So the thing that's very interesting to note is that the low energy excitation in the system are predominantly localized. They are not extended. Of course, there will be extended excitations. I mean, there's always a Goldstone mode in any system. But actually, if you look at the scaling of the Goldstone, the energy of the Goldstone mode versus the scaling of the localized excitation, you find that the localized excitation go to zero much faster. They are exponentially going at the system size simply because these are excitations that are localized around impurities that are far away from where the carriers are.
How does the resistivity behave experimentally with functional things?
That I had previously in one of those. I don't. No. Those were experiments. Those were experiments. Yeah, those were not calculations. No. Okay. All right.
But the density you have shown is your calculation.
Yeah, density of states. Yeah. No, we haven't actually done any transport calculations at this stage. Because I think transport calculations are very sensitive to the precise model because you need the full nature of the wave function. We can do it. It's not a problem doing that. We just don't have the... many of the parameters that have been used in the system were... since then, there's still controversy about whether all the parameters are the same. I think Nicola's parameter is different from Bharacharjee and Guillaume's parameters to some extent. So we want all those things settled before we make any calculations. We've done various other extensions of the model, and now we're looking at transport properties to try and understand using the wave functions we calculate from mean field. There's one thing that we have completely neglected, which is the fact that spin orbit coupling exists in the valence band of gallium manganese arsenide. And this is a point that has been raised very much by Zarand and Yanko, that if you have anisotropy, you can have anisotropy in the exchange interaction because of spin orbit coupling. If that is one of the problems in this system, is that even though they are ferromagnets, saturation has not been seen. Except at very high fields. So the question is, why does it not saturate? Why is the magnetization less than what fully ferromagnetic? And while our answer is that there are a bunch of moments that are not coupled to the ferromagnetic backbone. There's another possibility, which is that there's some frustration in this effective spin interactions, and that's a possibility raised by Zarand and Yanko, and we're looking at that on a phenomenological level. Then there are, of course, the whole issue is the impurity band model that we have adequate or not, and the point there is that there has been studies both in angle resolved photo emission and scanning tunneling microscopy which suggest that there is actually an impurity band in the system which is separated from the host conduction or valence band in this case. So we think that there is some impurity band physics that is important in trying to understand gallium manganese arsenide or most magnetic diluted magnetic semiconductors. It's more complicated, but it's also more interesting to look at that.
Do people know at which concentration of manganese the impurity band merges with the valence or the conduction band?
They haven't managed to get more than 5% manganese in there. It's actually, the reason why magnetic semiconductor or diluted magnetic semiconductors were not studied that much is because these systems are really metastable. They're not stable. So you need very good people to figure out how to get the magnetic ions in the concentration you want. In the 2-6s, you can get 80% manganese, and there's no problem there. But then that they are not very useful technologically. So that's the, at least as far as ferromagnetism is concerned.
But you also have this compensation issue because you don't know.
Right. Right.
How accurately can they determine the number of carriers? Is the Hall effects?
Yeah, that's what they're doing that. Well, that's how they do it. I mean, they're doing it standard ways. And one of the questions that our study has raised is that if there is this issue of disorder being important, it may not be as clear in the case of the low density systems. Right. It may be fine at the higher densities.
I mean, for example, for a fixed concentration of the manganese, how widely varying is the carrier concentration? I mean, how much is the concentration?
Factor of 3 at least, I think. What? It does vary, yeah, factor of 2, factor of 3. TCs varies by factor of 2, depending on the precise treatment you do. Supposed to do the annealing at 290 Kelvin, you get the magic system, you anneal it at some other temperature, and then it's gone. So one of the other thing that is more quite important to study, these are MBE grown samples that have been sort of, who knows how long they're going to last. That's the other issue. I think one issue that might be worth looking at is it possible to go to bulk systems which are more stable? And various groups are going to other systems. I mean,
so all of this has been done on just thin films?
This has been done on thin films. There has been a lot, but there are other groups doing bulk material. At Princeton, we're doing chalcopyrites, which is not with the aim. I mean, there the aim is not necessarily to get the highest TC, but somewhat to understand what the real mechanism for the ferromagnetism is. I think there are two different issues here, which need to be separately addressed. At least it'd be good if they both have the same resolution, but we should at least try both sides. And so I think I want to stop at that stage and just say that this is a very interesting system to study, not just from technological point of view, but from the physics point of view. There are some very interesting questions. At least I would love to hear from any one of you, if you've seen magnetization curves that are that unusual. And I have not ever seen that possible in any standard magnetic models that I've seen to date. And the fact that you have all this entropy that's left in the ferromagnetic phase, and so there's a lot of thermodynamics in the ferromagnetic phase, not just simply extended spin waves and that's it. I'll stop there. Thank you. I think I exhausted it.
Well, if there aren't any.
Is there positive or negative magnetic resistance in these materials? If you just look at
negative.
Because you're aligning all the manganese.
Manganese is the magnet. That's right, spin scattering. Yeah. Right.
In your model, what are the order of magnitude of the TIJs and the J? Is it the strong coupling or the weak coupling or intermediate?
Intermediate. It's sort of intermediate, at least in our model. It's not strong coupling.
But you believe that the physics should be gleaned by starting from the weak coupling end or from the strong coupling end of that model? Or none of the above?
Physics should be clean, you mean? Or physics should be...
Yes.
No, in my... See, at low densities, disorder is important, whether you take the strong coupling or the weak coupling. And it's Because, yeah, in order to get ferromagnetism on extended scale, you need the carriers to hop. Or at least have an exchange coupling.
I mention that because it's well known that if you have a condor lattice with a small number of holes, it's ferromagnetic.
Right.
So I'm just wondering whether you are taking some continuation of that well-established physics, or there's something new that needs to be added to that model.
What this is saying is that the disordered version of that is very similar. It is certainly true that that we need the ferromagnetism is coming. Is coming because few carriers are mediating the interaction, and that you can only have ferromagnetism in that limit. I mean, I don't see how you'll get anti-ferromagnetism.
Yeah, and disorder makes the thing go up or go down.
Disorder seems to make TC go up,
that's a
I don't know whether it's a puzzle. I think I gave you a scenario where it does. I mean, the reason why it does is because the system is—it's becoming filamentary ferromagnetism, and it's as if the concentration is larger than what you think it is. It's going along the percolating path. I'm not saying that you can really take this polaron picture and apply it directly to the 3.5s, but it looks like when you put it into a truly hopping electron model, you can get that kind of phenomena occurring.
Higher concentration, like a 3 or 4%, and the thermal transition temperature is in the order of 100 Kelvin. And then the, as far as I see, the resistivity essentially show a seamless behavior on that.
Yeah.
So it doesn't show any
sudden change of resistivity. No, it doesn't. At ferromagnetic. It's very, very weak. So that's another reason why, I mean, at least in our model, it says that the onset of ferromagnetism sort of is just a percolative type of transition. So it's not very, it's not affecting most of the spin. It's just.
Because the large polaron is already formed.
Right, well above the trunk. Yeah. Yes.
What's the external regions of the spin is 5 half?
I think the 5 halves has already been established at very low concentrations. I think through ESR and other measurements.
I'm asking because people doing first principles calculation always get about 4 magnetons per manganese.
I see.
That would mean a spin 2.
Right.
Which means we wouldn't have to worry about orbital resistance.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And that would be completely different physics.
No, that would be different. No, that would be different. I agree with that.
Are you aware of whether people did X-ray circular dichrosomes to get the spin moment?
No, I'm not aware of that.
They have done that, and I can give you the reference, but it was basically that it was in his research. There was some ambiguity in his dissertation.
I see.
I don't understand the details of the experiment, but. I think it's an open question whether it's a D4 or
D5. I see.
Or something intermediate.
So if it's D4, then where's the other electron?
Well, if some of them don't, if some of them go in as manganese 3, they don't.
I see. Okay. All right. Okay. No, it could be more complicated. That's certainly true. I think to that extent, the 2.6s are very clean because the manganese goes in as spin 5.
For the
3.5. Yeah, no, for the 3.5. Well, yeah. There are all kinds of questions about the 3.5s, stability and everything else. So I think that it may be worthwhile from the physics community's point of view to actually take a step back, go to systems that we understand well, try and understand the magnetic phenomena in that system, and then go tackle the 3.5s. But you know how agencies are. They want the gallium manganese arsenide. They don't want to know about cadmium manganese telluride. Yes.
How well is magnesium local moment defined? So it's really local, and if it's local, is there any effect of indirect exchange or super exchange?
We think not at these concentrations. As I said in the beginning, when you take 2.6s and you put manganese instead of cadmium or zinc, you get spin glass transitions for 20% manganese. But below that is just a bunch of clusters. There's a nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor exchange. People have actually quantitatively tried to understand magnetization in these systems in terms of clusters of 2 manganese, 3 manganese, 4, 5 manganese, things like that. Peter Wolf is and a group in Boston or thereabouts are the ones who do these measurements.
Okay.
But there the coupling is
antiferromagnetic. Antiferromagnetic, nearest neighbor. Next nearest neighbor is ferromagnetic. That's what. That's how they fit the data. I mean, it's actually, by fitting the data that you get out these coupling constants.
Yeah. What is the magnitude?
The TCs are about 20 degrees. So that's the magnitude of the. So actually, the ferromagnetism really overwhelms that. So one of the very interesting physics question is: you take one of these spin glass systems and pump it with carriers. What happens? Does it become ferromagnetic or not? That's something that might be worth looking at. You take cadmium manganese telluride with, you can get up to 50% manganese in there if you want. So the question is, how many carriers does it take to spoil the manganese ordered state and get you into ferromagnetism? Or is it possible to do that? Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I completely understand your argument about TC increasing with these other.
Right.
Why wouldn't that apply to simpler disorder model like just random fieldizing, for example? Because they're also presumably the cluster that order is some elementary thing.
I guess that I have to say that motion of TC is not universal, so we don't know necessarily. I'm giving a plausibility argument. That is what we find when we do Monte Carlo simulation. That is what we do. I mean, mean field certainly gives that, and that's it's a huge effect. It's factor of 3. But I think that's completely artifact of mean field theory. But even in Monte Carlo simulations, it looks like it is a 50% to 80% increase we can get by disordering the lattice. Shin has also done the 2.6s back again, try to compare the ordered super lattice of manganese versus the randomly placed manganese. And again, it seems to be about 50% increase with the random system.
The statement is if TC goes up that much at fixed carrier concentration?
Fixed carrier, right.
Not manganese concentration.
No, we have kept the manganese concentration and carrier concentration fixed. And we just, the only thing that we do is disorder the manganese. And we find TC goes up. But the magnetization is not as high. I mean, it just starts earlier and then goes below what the ordered case is. So it's as if there's a certain backbone that is forming. It's interesting that in the other cases we never see higher TC. I know that a lot of people in the phase transition literature are surprised with this result.
But this saturation business, you are saying that you have these filamentary passes of
right.
And there are other manganese impurities which are not contributing to the.
They are not until lower temperature.
Would you assume that they couple antiferromagnetically?
We're still keeping them as if they're coupling ferromagnetically. We did not keep the manganese-manganese exchange. There's one other thing that we have not done, which is you have to, in all these systems, you have to have ultimately dipolar magnetic exchange also. And that will dominate if you push everything down to very low temperatures. But at least in the 3.5 model, we have kept, it becomes fully saturated at zero temperature. It's just that it takes a low temperature to get them to actually get coupled to the ferromagnetic backbone. But, all those things are not, they are not robust results, because those things will have, if you have some very weak coupling, something else might also be there, which we may not have put in our model. It's certainly telling you why you're not getting full saturation down to TC over 5, for example.
All right, if there are no further questions, let's thank Robin again.